The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're learning about the ever-expanding streams of our personal information being collected by businesses and governments. Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. With me is Dr. Thomas P. Keenan, one of the world's top computer security experts, a fellow of the Canadian Information Processing Society and the Canadian Defense and Foreign Affairs Institute. In 2012, he received the NSERC Award for Science Promotion and hosted the award-winning CBC Ideas series, Crimes of the Future. He's a regular contributor to CBC Radio and Television and lectures throughout the world on cybersecurity. He's here today to talk about his new book, Techno Creep: The Surrender of Privacy and the Capitalization of Intimacy. Tom, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Rochelle.
Maybe let's start by defining techno creep. What does that term mean to you?
Well, it's an attempt to be a pun. First of all, technology is creeping into our lives. So just about everything has technology. I write in the book about a bar in Boston where there are now five cameras that watch all the patrons. And you can use an app called SceneTap to look at that bar and figure out how full it is, but also the ratio of males to females and the average age of the people there. So when you think about that, that's something as sacrosanct as our local watering hole that now has some creepy technology in it. The other side, of course, is that there are literally techno creeps. There are people who are turning on web cameras. Miss Teen USA had the experience of being allegedly blackmailed. She was, in fact, sent photographs, nude photographs of herself that were taken through the camera of her computer. So there are creepy people doing creepy things with technology.
So your book is filled with examples of technologies that are creepy now and possibly up-and-coming technologies that have high creepy potential. And instead of deep diving into just a couple of examples, it feels like you really tried to give as many examples as you could and provide incredibly robust citations for those who'd like to deep dive on their own.
Well, you know, I wanted to illustrate that it's in every aspect of our life, so I challenge myself. I've written scholarly books, you know, that go into, you know, one particular vulnerability and what's about it, but I want to give people a mindset. So I have chapters in there like why your children are creepy, why your pets are creepy, things that you wouldn't think about. It would be far too easy to just write a book that goes, yes, there are a whole bunch of surveillance cameras, yes, they are being tied together and they're spying on us. That would, you know, lots of other people, Glenn Greenwald and lots of people have tackled that. I want to, you know, bite off a harder challenge, which is to show that technology is getting into just about everything. And, you know, amazingly, after finishing the book, new things come out that kind of prove the point. There's now a product called Amazon Echo. It's kind of like Siri. It's a personal assistant. You buy it by invitation only now. You put it in your house, and it has seven microphones. It's always listening. Now, that's creepy because even though Amazon says, oh, we're not doing anything bad, you don't know that for sure, and that's really the underlying premise. We don't really know what's going on.
And I get the feeling that with as many examples as you've provided, this is still a tip of the iceberg scenario.
Absolutely. There's no question that we just keep finding, you know, new ways in which things are creepy. So I go on and look at the Adam and estate sale, and there's a chandelier, and I go, that's pretty interesting. I click on the picture, and all of a sudden an ad for chandeliers.com appears in the corner. Now, I'm technical enough that I pull down the ad and I look and I say, oh, okay, that was called chandeliers.jpg, the actual name of the file. Maybe that's how Google figured it out. Then I read Google is experimenting with image recognition to find out what's in a photograph. The creepy part is we don't know what they're doing. It's all kind of secret sauce. And I'm not just talking within the government. I mean, there are corporations out there that are using our data, and they don't have a lot of obligation to tell us what they're doing with it because we sign off on these blanket terms and conditions, and we pretty well give away the farm.
I do want to dive into corporations and business in just a second, but I do want to stop for a moment and talk about government, because your book has come out at a time when the issue of government collection of our data is big news. Thanks to the Snowden leaks, more people are aware of the data they create and who else might be looking at it or using it. Do you think this is a good thing?
There are certainly good uses for it. We have a woman in Canada who bought a lottery ticket. And she forgot all about the lottery ticket, and the Ontario Lottery Commission, which is a government agency, basically tracked her down through her credit card purchases, through her surveillance photos in the drugstore where she bought it. So there's like one lady, and she won $50 million. She's real happy that there was surveillance.
I bet.
We shouldn't be happy. Most of us, we should be worried because, you know, we have this general premise in society that we can walk out to our car and everything's fine. I've been looking around at cameras. I used to go to a conference where we counted cameras, and we would go to the bar after we found 100. Now that takes about like 3 minutes in any major city. The question, of course, is what's being done with that data. In the case of the lottery woman, she actually, several months had passed since she bought that ticket and forgot about it. That tells me that they're keeping this information for a long time. So one of the sneakier things is that the information is out there. The other thing is that governments are starting to put information out on us. There's a whole open government movement where they publish things. And I like to torture databases, so I will go in there and I'll download like all the political contributions for Philadelphia. And then I go through them and I find, hey, there's a guy from Massachusetts who contributed to Philadelphia. That's interesting. Or, hey, a lot of people seem to give the same address. I go on Google Maps. That's the hiring hall for a union. So obviously something's going on there where the union is saying, oh, you want an electrician job? Well, you know, this candidate is really good. You might want to make a contribution.
The various government organizations that have been targets of the Snowden leaks, they insist they need this data to protect people, and that if you've done nothing wrong, you've got nothing to hide.
Oh, I don't believe that. I've got an example in the book where a guy found himself in the police information database as a known associate of a mafioso. This guy was assigned part in stall number 12. The mafia guy, unbeknownst to him who he was in stall number 11. They said good morning every day. Hello, hello. Well, you know, the reality is the mafia guy was under surveillance, and this guy's license plate is run, and all of a sudden he's in the database as known associate. People can be the victim of confusion. I interviewed one guy who was an engineer, who would really good engineer. He would get job interviews, and then he'd never get the job. And he finally had somebody pull his called public data file, which is ironic because it's actually not public. It's only available to headhunters and people like that. And the headhunter who got it for him said, well, of course you don't get a job. You're a convicted murderer. His file had been crossed over with a murderer's file, but he didn't know about that. So there can be wrong information. There can be incomplete information. And we don't really have the ability to look at that information.
As someone who has previously worked for a government organization, do you think Snowden was right to leak the documents?
I don't think it would have come out any other way, so I think it was necessary. I've had a wonderful talk, not with him, but with his parents. So I know that he meant well. You know, it's hard to come. I mean, some people say he's jeopardized people's lives and things like that. I think this had to come out, and it's pretty clear he's been an inspiration to other people. There are apparently other leakers who are bringing out this information. The reality is we ought to be smart enough that we can collect information that's necessary for terrorism. We had a terrible tragedy in Ottawa, and I am all for every kind of surveillance camera on Parliament Hill. So if you are going to go and walk up the steps of our Parliament building in Canada, you ought to be facially identified. They can bring up your police record, and that's fine. But if you're two blocks away walking into a shopping mall, I don't think we need that type of technology there.
With the Snowden leaks, of course, many people are increasingly aware that the government wants our data. But as you mentioned before, and which your book makes very clear, they aren't the only organization that does. Increasingly, large companies want our data very badly.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there's a great example in the book, Target knows teenage girl is pregnant before her father. And as the story goes, it was reported in the New York Times, Target is very interested in girls when they're having their first baby. They not only spend a lot of money on baby things, they also change their purchasing habits. It's kind of a life-changing time. So in Minneapolis, there was a fellow who came into a Target store and he said, are you trying to tell my 16-year-old daughter to have sex? You're sending her baby stuff. And of course, the target had based this on her purchasing habits. These included certain kinds of vitamins and lotions, and they made a reasonable guess that this girl was trying to have a baby. And the dad was angry. The store manager apologized. 2 weeks later, dad calls back, and he says, it's my turn to apologize. There were some things going on in my house I didn't know about. She's due in August. Target responded, and here's the creepy part. They said, oh, yeah, that's creepy that, you know, we know she's pregnant, but hey, we really want her business. They started sending out to pregnant women flyers that contain power drills and wine glasses and things that they're not interested in. And the premise was, if she doesn't know we're doing it, it's not creepy. And that's why I wrote the book, so that people know they're doing it.
That is a really interesting thing about all of this. It seems like sometimes the real issue here is transparency, not necessarily that they're collecting the data, not necessarily that it's being used in some cases a relatively harmless way or seemingly harmless way. It's that we don't know they're doing it.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of it, but there's also a kind of understanding. So if you walk around, I just heard someone on TV talking about new jobs, and she was pretty naive. She said, and I hear there are jobs called webmaster and big data analytics. I don't even know what they are. And, you know, if you stop people on the street and said, what does a big data analyst do? You would get, you know, pretty weird answers. So I don't think a lot of people even have the underlying framework to realize how creepy this is. And I suggest in the book that one of the creepiest places in America, at least, is the Disney theme park. Now, when you go there, they put a bracelet on you. It's called a My Magic wristband, and it tracks you everywhere you are in the park. They know every ride you go on. Also, it's sending information. So you have your little 5-year-old niece, Sally, with you. They see Snow White, who might be Sally's favorite character, sees on her display Sally is approaching. Sally is 5 years old. Her birthday is. And her remaining spending limit for today is $39. So the reality is they have this ability to track people. And you can say no. You can say, I don't want that wristband. Give me a paper ticket. And they will say, sir, here's your paper ticket. But you do know, this means you lose all your privileges. With the wristband, you can go to the front of the line 3 times a day, maybe. Imagine telling Sally, well, you know, we're standing online in the hot sun because we value our privacy, but that family doesn't, so they're getting right on the ride.
It's very much like manipulation, and it feels a little bit like the early days of advertising, where people would discover ways of getting people to do certain things, and now it's data that we're using, and we don't know people are using that data.
That's right. I torture e-commerce sites, so I just put an order in on cooking.com, you know, a website that sells kitchen stuff, and then I abandon my cart. Well, they are harassing me. Is there anything else you want? What was wrong with our stuff? You know, this is fine. I mean, I accept those emails, or I can put them in my spam folder or whatever, but you're absolutely right. The businesses are becoming extremely sophisticated in ways that they try to get into our minds. And, you know, a lot of people have said the technology is out there to know what you want even before you know that you want it. So suggestions are coming up based on your patterns. We had some very creepy stuff where Orbitz, a big travel site, was actually checking what browser you came from. And if you came from Safari, which is associated with Apple computers, which are more expensive, it showed you more expensive hotels. So, you know, the CFO of the company was interviewed and said, of course, people who can afford, you know, $3,000 laptops don't want to stay in the youth hostel. They want to see the Hilton. So he actually defended that you got different browsing results based upon what computer you came from.
This increasing personalization of our internet experience is really quite interesting. In some cases, it can be extraordinarily helpful. So, for example, I'm on Amazon.com. I'm browsing books. It shows me what other books I might like to read. And in some cases, I would say in a lot of cases, they're probably pretty accurate. But I've also heard of instances where the personalization in search engines, I'm thinking specifically here, the Google search engine, can cause issues of sort of reinforcing our own bubble, where they are showing us what we want to find, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're giving us an accurate overview of what's actually out there on that topic.
Absolutely. And there's some very subtle things. The Civil Liberties Union in California accused Apple with their personal assistant Siri of not showing results for abortion clinics. And they said, you know, you go into Siri and you say, I want an abortion, or show me the nearest abortion clinic, and you're directed to some agency that wants you not to have the abortion. Well, when you dig a little deeper, and this is where being technical helps, abortion clinics rarely put the name abortion in their title. Siri was just being somewhat mechanistic. It was saying, okay, I can't find abortion, but I'll try to figure out what's related to that. So it actually was kind of a false claim against Apple, because it wasn't really Siri's fault. It was the way the world is structured. So, you know, people, if they don't think about that, they can jump to conclusions. It is helpful that you and I see different results on Google, but it is certainly true that, we're being reinforced. We're seeing things that, we want to see, and Facebook is the greatest example of that. I mean, it's a country club where you actually only see what other people who are like-minded think. There's a guy named Dean Terry in Texas who invented a new concept on Facebook called enemy. And you could declare, you know, Bill Gates is my enemy, bunnies are my enemy, or something like that. Normally, Facebook would take something like this down right away because it's negative, it's bad. You know, you can't have that on Facebook. They left this one up, and our speculation is they left it up because it reinforces, it gives them more information about you. So now we know that you and I both hate bunny rabbits, and the day will come when there's a bunny eradication powder or something, and they can sell it to us. So, you know, Facebook are no dummies. They're trying to collect information, including what we don't like.
Facebook's really interesting because here is a platform where we share oftentimes incredibly personal details about ourselves for the purpose of sharing that with a close circle of friends, or, you know, depending on how you use Facebook, maybe not such a close circle of friends. But, you know, then you hear people who announce their engagement on Facebook and then see nothing but wedding-related ads for, like, months and months.
Well, my son actually was silly enough to leave his Facebook account logged in, and one of his friends pranked him by putting, "Hey, I'm going to be a dad."
Oh, no.
And my son looked at it, and, you know, he's in his 20s, and he left it there. And he actually did an experiment of watching, you know, all the congratulations. And, of course, his mother went berserk because, "Why didn't you tell me you announced it on Facebook?" and stuff like that. So, you know, there are ample ways to prank people. I heard one recently, actually, where a roommate kind of wanted to drive his roommate nuts. So he started buying targeted ads on Facebook. And it's a little weird, but they lived in New York City. The roommate was a sword swallower, that he could perform sword swallowing, but he had trouble swallowing pills. Sounds bizarre, but it was true. This guy started to see targeted ads. "Are you a sword swallower who has trouble getting pills down in the morning?" And, you know, he's going crazy. The interesting thing is the guy who wrote about this said, "And my total cost to drive my roommate totally insane was $3.22. So with targeted Facebook ads, he was actually, you know, able to really give his roommate quite an entertaining and frightening experience.
You're listening to Science for the People, and we're learning about our electronic information trails with Tom Keenan, author of Technocreep, The Surrender of Privacy and the Capitalization of Intimacy. We'll be back with more after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and I'm talking with Tom Keenan, science writer, futurist, and author of the book Technocreep, about the often invisible ways that businesses and governments collect our personal information. I do want to talk about social media for a minute, because we often hear warnings about what we shouldn't post about ourselves on social media, and obviously there's a lot of stories about people getting fired or worse with the things that they may post or that may get on the internet. But part of the problem is it's social media. I can control what I post about me, but I can't really control what other people post about me, and this seems to be the greater problem we're running into.
It's even worse because not only can't you control them, but the technology is out there to tag you in photographs. Facebook actually has the ability, if they want to turn it on, to auto-tag so that every photo would be recognized, you know, that they could go out there and do that. And you're absolutely right. It's out of your control. One of the things that inspired me to write the book was a bizarre app. It was a smartphone app called Girls Around Me. And many young people particularly like to use Foursquare to check in. So, hey, I'm in this bar. You know, all my friends come down. What Girls Around Me did is it unified, through your email address, your Foursquare check-in with your Facebook profile. So now creepy guy walks into a bar, sees all the girls who have checked in there with poorly secured Facebook profiles, and goes, Sally, she's not in a relationship. She's kind of cute, and, oh, her favorite band is. And, you know, he walks over armed with all this information about Sally. She has no idea how he knows this. So I came up in my book with the theory of creep, and one of the things that's creepy is when one side understands it and the other side doesn't.
And it's not just photos or poorly secured personal profiles. It seems like a perfectly innocent click of the like button when assessed in bulk can paint a pretty eerily accurate portrait of somebody.
Absolutely. There is a paper called You Are What You Like that with just your Facebook likes is able to go out there and characterize you. One of the weirdest things I found in social media, there's actually a bank that sets your lending rate based on your Facebook friends. Now, it's optional. You can just say, hey, I just want a loan, and they'll give you some high rate. But if you give them access to your Facebook profile, they will then check your friends and see if any of them have taken loans from them. And if they did they pay the loan off? If you default on them, you then become one of the bad guys, and you negatively affect all the lending rates of your friends. So that's kind of creepy.
So there's another issue with some of our social stuff and some of the ways we are now sharing pictures. And I'm thinking, of course, of the kind of hack kiddies we are hearing about more and more, the people who are increasingly able to hack into different services without, I think, as much effort as maybe they used to. Or maybe it's just the information is more readily available and more people are interested in doing it. But we're getting things like massive release of, for instance, celebrity naked imagery online. That this is stuff that was never posted to any kind of social sites. It was, you know, shared between one expects consenting adults, and now it's kind of out there. How do we protect ourselves against that kind of techno creep?
Your best advice, if you're going to take a photo like that, hand it to the person you want to have it on a USB stick or something like that, and tell them to only view it in the privacy of their home without being connected to the internet. That is a particularly creepy thing, by the way, because, you know, a lot of photographs are tagged with location information. So your camera, your smartphone, if the GPS is on, it will record where the photo was taken. This was discovered 6 or 7 years ago, and right away Instagram, Facebook, all those services said, oh boy, we better cut this metadata, as it's called, off the pictures. And they do. Now, when you talk about the celebrity photos that you mentioned, they were uploaded to iCloud automatically, probably by their phones, and that data was never stripped off. So when the bad guys brought those photos down, they actually not only had Jennifer Lawrence's nude body, they had locations, you know, what store she shopped in, maybe where she lived. And, you know, the average person would never think about this. They would say, oh, yeah, they got nude photos. Well, they not only got nude photos, they got information that could be used to stalk these people, and that's pretty serious.
Is it just me, or does it seem like this kind of hacking is easier than it used to be? I mean, it's always happened since the internet's been around, but it seems like the incidents of it happening are increasing and we're hearing more about it. Is it actually easier to do this kind of hacking? Do people need specialized skills? Or I guess I'm asking, are there apps for this?
Yeah, I'm going to give you a specific example. So the guy who hacked Miss Teen USA, who's in jail now, by the way, did it by buying a piece of software off the internet called Black Shades, and apparently it cost $35. So all he needed to do was two things: make that purchase, so he's now got Black Shades, which is a hacking kit. It allows you to remotely activate the camera in somebody's computer, and then he had to trick her with a phishing email. Now, you know, you can imagine that, oh, we'd like to consider you for a modeling job or something like that would cause Miss Teen USA to instantly open the email, right? Please open this attachment for more details. So for whatever reason, she had a computer in her bedroom, not a wise place for a 16-year-old girl to have a computer with a camera. She fell for the phishing email, and sure enough, this guy got some, you know, fairly nude photos of her and then blackmailed her. He said, I'm going to ruin your career. I'll post these unless you give me more photos or you do a private Skype session with me. She did the right thing. She went to the law enforcement, and this guy is in jail. So the reality is, he didn't need a computer science degree to do that. He just needed to know that there was something called Black Shades and have $35.
I think that's what's really troubling about some of this. It's not necessarily just that governments have our data and corporations have our data, which to some extent is troubling enough. It's that if someone's angry at us or upset at us that an individual person without a huge amount of skills or time can take out vengeance, what is essentially vengeance, in a really troubling way.
So I, again, with my son, not with his permission, I went into a program called Spokio, and all you need is somebody's name and their email address. And I didn't even pay for the premium version, and I called him up. I said, hey, I hear you like such and such a band. He said, how'd you know that? I said, well, it's on your playlist on Last.fm. How'd you know I have a playlist on that? And so we now have a non-proliferation treaty. He's a pretty good hacker, too, so we don't hack each other anymore. But I was demonstrating that just with public information that he's happily disclosed, I could find out about him. I took another guy that was actually published the places where people who have gun permits live in the area in Rockland County and Westchester County, just north of New York City. And I looked at that map. It was published by a newspaper. And I said, I used to live in the Bronx, actually. I said, my gosh, there's one of those guys lives right near. He lives actually in the city. He lives right near where I used to walk by every day. So I just decided for fun to stalk him as best I could. I found out how much his house is worth. I found out he has a post office box. I found out his approximate age, you know, all kinds of information, all without spending a penny. I didn't buy any of the premium, you know, private eye type services. I just used, you know, basic hacker skills and, you know, from stuff that he had posted there already or that was publicly available. I mean, a site called Zillow will give you an estimate of how much his house is worth. You put all this information together, then you use something like Google Maps where you can actually look at the person's house, and that gets pretty creepy.
So it seems like smartphones are one of the technological advancements that are really opening up a can of worms on the techno-creepy front. Like I said, there are quite literally apps for this. You talk in your book about apps used to track your boyfriend, apps used to track your kids.
Well, you know, and they may have good purposes. I mean, I know one of the phone services in Canada has a Find My Phone app, right? And you can also put it on all your family members. So if you want to know where your wife or husband is, you can push a button and it will give you their location. Now, they have to give their permission for that from their phone. But, of course, if you have their phone, you can say yes to it. Where it gets creepier is, as you mentioned, the boyfriend tracker down in Brazil. If a girl thinks her boyfriend is cheating, she gets his phone, puts a rastrado de namorado on the phone, and all of a sudden, everything he does is being sent to her. This includes everything that the microphone hears. It can even turn on the camera in it. So if he's cheating, she's going to find out about it pretty quickly. And there's no indication when you look at the phone that all this is happening. You take Google Glass. You know, there have been lots and lots of cases now where people have been wearing Google Glass and they're filming. And you go, are they filming or not? There's a little light that tells you they are. But one of the first accessories that came out for Google Glass was a sunshade that also covers over that light. So there are people walking around who are just like tapping their glasses and recording you, and you have no idea.
It's very easy reading your book and hearing some of these cases to be overwhelmed by this, to kind of become really paranoid. How concerned should we be?
We should be really concerned. I mean, it depends, you know, how much you care about your privacy. There are people who say, my life is an open book. Generally, if somebody says that, within about a minute, I can find something that embarrasses them. I have a chapter in the book called Anti-Creep that has to do with ways to throw people and companies off your digital trail. One of the simplest ones is to have a bunch of different email addresses. So you have one for work, one for home, one for your magazine subscriptions, one for your porn surfing, if that's what you do. If you just use a single email for all those, you're making yourself very easy to track.
So, like you say, there is a chapter at the end of your book where you get into a lot of this. And your suggestions range from things I would think of as obvious, like strengthening passwords, using two-factor authentication where it's available, to things that get much more involved. Like you said, having dozens of different email accounts or potentially creating fake identities. Given there are a lot of people out there apparently still using 123456 as a password, how many people do you think will make use of your more time-consuming tips?
You know, the two-factor authentication is fascinating. You take Gmail, for example, and what you can do is you can set it up so that it will send you an SMS message on your phone whenever you're at a new computer. Now, the kind of attitude I want people to think about is, oh, that's, you know, probably useful. That's probably good. Now, wait a minute. How does Google know when I'm at a new computer? And the answer is, for Gmail, Google is keeping a list of every computer that you've used. They've followed your travels. They know everywhere you've been. That's how they know when you're at a new place. So, you know, one of the things that's certainly good to use two-factor authentication, only a small percentage of people do that, but there's always something in the background. The phone on your smartphone, you mentioned smartphones, you look at your phone right now, it will probably have every Wi-Fi network you've connected to, unless you've taken the trouble to clear them. I saw a guy do a demonstration, held up a phone, said, oh, Royal Bank of Scotland employee site. Well, I know where you work. The British Airways first class lounge, I know you're a high roller. Oh, dear, I didn't realize Hooters has a Wi-Fi service. So, you know, you're giving away information. Somebody picks up your phone, and they can look at all the places you've been. I suggest that people get a little aggressive and clear that information so that you're not leaving a digital trail that you don't want to leave.
I get into this a little bit in my own personal life, and I do try and protect my data where I can, but I have to admit that protecting our identities and data, if you get really into it, it's a little bit exhausting. Given the trade-off between the usefulness of services like Gmail and Amazon and Target, and the effort one has to go through to keep our data private, is it worth it, do you think, for the average person just going about their lives?
I think it is worth it. Some things are dead easy. So in Canada, our postal codes are alphanumeric. A valid postal code is ho, ho, ho. It happens to get all the mail sent to Santa Claus. When a company asks me to sign up, you know, I will give North Pole and ho, 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 and if they accept it, great. I wanted a Safeway card when there were still Safeway cards, and you'd be dumb not to have one because it gets you a discount on your food. If you don't have it, you're overpaying for your food. But they don't need to send me mail, so I give them an address in Bangkok. If they're sending me mail, that's where it's going. You're perfectly allowed to do that. You're not breaking any law by telling the Safeway you live in Bangkok. The reality is companies want our data. They want to use it for marketing. Safeway happens to know every single thing you buy on that card, but there's a great hack where a guy has posted his card online, encouraged people to download the barcode, and now hundreds of this guy are shopping at different Safeway stores all over North America. So I think people are ready to fight back on some of this information. And, you know, it's as simple as saying to the clerk at the store when they ask for your phone number, I don't want to give that. And if they insist, have a ready phone number. I give a formula in the book that will give you a Hollywood phone number in your area code, because there are 200 numbers reserved in each area code for TV and movie use, so that they don't give a real phone number. And they're not hard to figure out. They start out with 555. Not all 555 numbers are usable, but if you do that, you're guaranteed it's a fakeable number.
So aside from trying to protect ourselves, which I think sometimes can seem like a bit of a losing battle, what else can we do? Can we change the system? Is there any hope that this kind of data mining or usage can be regulated?
I want to say, first of all, we need to protect our children. I have some very creepy examples in the book of the misuse of children's photos and children's information. So we definitely want to pass on to the next generation, right from birth, that we don't want to be sharing that information. If you read the book, you'll see your child's photo can be misused in some very creepy ways. In terms of laws, you know, it's a hard thing. There's a big industry in the U.S. of selling mugshots. You get arrested in Florida, the sheriff posts your photo, mugshots.com scrapes that off that site, and they will post it as a public service to show that you've been arrested. And they defend their right to do that, and it's legal for them to do it. They also have an unpublishing service. If you give them $700, they'll take your photo down. Oregon tried to pass a law against this, and, you know, with the best of intentions. But what I've learned is that what's going to kill this is actually technological change, because Google, realizing that these are sleazy businesses, are now downrating in their search engine rankings mugshot results. So if you have a whole great life and then you get arrested for something, that shouldn't come up first. The payment processors, Visa, MasterCard, are going to make it so these people can't use their services. Sometimes the answer is legal. Often the answer is technological. And almost always the answer is in our heads. You know, we have to have an attitude. And that's why I wrote the book, so people can have this skeptical attitude. If you want to tell the store, the Keith's Brewery, your exact birthday, go ahead. But you don't have to.
It's really interesting. It seems like in some cases it's not the government we should be pushing against. It sounds like it's other companies who can control the cash flow or the notoriety of these places, like you mentioned Google or PayPal.
And the way they share it, there's a wonderful film, Terms and Conditions May Apply. I recommend it to everyone. They estimate that you're worth $500 a year to Google if you use Gmail and G Drive and YouTube and all that. And that's because that's what they can sell advertising information and other information on you. And there's no way to say to Google, here's my $500 now, you know, protect my privacy. They are just, you know, no, you want our services, they're free, but we're paying with our privacy. And I want people to know that there is a cost.
Tom, thanks so much for being here and for giving us a lot to think about.
I hope I haven't scared you too much, but I hope I made you think.
If you want to learn more about Tom Keenan or his book Technocreep, The Surrender of Privacy and the Capitalization of Intimacy, you can find the links to get you started on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. In just a minute, we'll be back with security expert Bruce Schneier to talk about the ways we use and misuse the humble password. Stay tuned.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. My next guest is Bruce Schneier, an internationally renowned security technologist called a security guru by The Economist. He's authored 12 books, including Liars and Outliers, Enabling the Trust Society Needs to Survive, as well as hundreds of articles, essays, and academic papers. He is a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, a program fellow at the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute, a board member of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, an advisory board member of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, and the chief technology officer at CO3 Systems. He also runs the popular Cryptogram newsletter and Schneier on Security blog. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
In the last 10 to 15 years, a lot of the tools we work with at our jobs and in our personal lives are now online. And a lot of these tools and that data is protected behind a password. I mean, I definitely use passwords more in my daily life now, even more than just a couple of years ago. How much of our data is currently password protected and how much of it is moving in that direction?
Very interesting question. I don't know if anyone's done a survey of how much is password protected. But if you think about anything you have in the cloud, whether it's a Google document or your email or Facebook, it's protected by a password. If you think of anything on your cell phone or your computer, it's protected by a password. It might be safe to say that pretty much everything online is password protected. I've never seen the data, but I can't think of anything that isn't password protected.
And it's not, of course, just the data I control about myself either. Data about me controlled by other people, for example, my medical records, is being digitized and one expects secured by password access.
Well, yes. And to be fair, it's not only a password. It's passwords and other things as well. But passwords are certainly part of our online security for every part of our lives. And you're right, for everybody else who has data about us.
It also seems like password cracking is easier than it used to be. It seems we hear about some sort of major password hack or attack almost every week or every other week. Is that because cracking is getting easier, because the tools are more available or computing power is more plentiful, or because the services with our passwords are not as secure as we'd like?
Yeah, basically, it's because computers are faster. If you think about how you would crack someone's password, when you were a kid, you wanted to break into a combination lock. What would you do? You would try every combination. I remember one, there was 3 digits, and there are 1,000 combinations. I remember it took me a few hours, but I did it. Now, that's an incredibly boring, repetitive task. And if you think about it, computers are great at repetitive, boring tasks. And computers have just gotten so fast that the task of guessing password after password has just gotten easier. But on top of that, computers are smarter at guessing passwords. They don't try, AAA all the way to ZZZZZ, in order. They try things like password first, or the name of your hometown, or the name of your favorite football team. So it's a combination of things. Password cracking has gotten faster just because computers are faster, and password cracking has gotten smarter because we have a better feel on what are common and likely passwords.
Are more people trying to crack our passwords? And is it getting easier for people maybe without hundreds of years of experience or dozens of years of experience to do that kind of cracking?
You don't need dozens of years of experience. You need, you know, a tool you download from the internet. Right? This is the computer age. To do something, you don't need experience. You just need a password cracking tool. And there are lots of them. There are password cracking tools that are legitimate. Right? Companies need this when an employee gets run over by a bus or leaves in a huff and their data is protected by a password, the company needs access to it. The government needs these sorts of tools when they're going after a criminal who might have data protected by a computer. And criminals and hackers use these tools. So don't think of it as experience, right? It's encapsulated in software.
I know that we also hear things like a retail service, they've had a bunch of username and passwords stolen kind of in bulk, or a retailer has had a bunch of credit card information stolen. Is this a fault in the security for those systems, or just an indication of how easy hacking is getting?
Well, it's going to be both. Right? The ease of hacking is because of the insecurity of the systems. What we find is that security is hard. And the more these systems are used in popular and non-technical applications, the less security they might have. So you might think of the large credit card breaches that happened in the United States over the past couple of years, and you know, tens of millions, 50 millions, you know, large numbers of credit card information, account numbers, sometimes passwords. This is due to the poor security of the networks, and is something that is just true. There are a lot of things these companies can do better. Until there's real liabilities, you know, I don't know the rules in Canada, but in the United States, there's not a lot of liabilities companies face for losing your information. You know, we're not seeing a lot of improvement.
As a user of an online service or as a patron of a retailer, is there a way for me to check on the quality of their IT security before I create an account or buy something with a credit card?
No, and that's one of the problems. If you call Google and say, you know, I'm thinking of having a Gmail account, can you tell me your security? They will say, and this is probably an exact quote, go away. You have no ability to check on the security of your social network, of your email provider, of a company you're doing business with that is storing your information on their networks. Your only choice is to trust them blindly or not use their system.
That's a little bit unsettling. Just before we really dive in and drill down, I want to talk big picture for a second. Overall, for the average person, how important is password security, and how well is the average person actually managing their passwords? Give us, sort of as a collective, a grade.
I fail. My passwords are very, very important. They're protecting your personal information. They're protecting your financial information. They're protecting your bank account, your money. And most people choose really, really lousy passwords. And that's what we find whenever we see data on what passwords look like, people choose terrible ones. Now, to be fair, some of this isn't our fault. We're sort of at the point where any password you choose, you can't remember. And you've been told never to write them down. So you've given a set of impossible tasks. So given that, people tend to choose bad passwords. They will reuse passwords. They'll choose dates. They'll choose names. They'll choose common words. They'll choose common words with a number after them. Now, we've reached the point where anything you can reasonably choose and remember is guessable.
Oh, that's not so good. That presents obviously some issues when we're talking to people about not reusing their passwords, because if you have to create a different random password for every account, that's a lot of post-it notes stuck to your computer.
Well, you don't stick them to computer. That's a mistake, right? Because then anybody at your computer can get at them. You know, what I advise people to do is to write them down on a piece of paper and store it securely with the other pieces of paper they find valuable. Now, we're actually really good at securing little pieces of paper. Right? It's called money, and we keep it in our wallet, and we basically almost never lose it. So the best thing people can do is to have long passwords. I'm thinking like 12 characters of random letters, numbers, and characters. Write them down on a little piece of paper, put it in their wallet, and whenever they need it, go to their wallet, pull it out, and type it.
I guess we can also talk a little bit about password managers as well. They're growing in popularity. There's a lot of services out there where you can essentially kind of create a digital piece of paper and a digital wallet for your passwords. Are those tools and services a good bet?
I like them. I use them. There's a password manager called PasswordSafe, which I designed and wrote, and that's what I do. It is a password manager. So the way this works is I have a single master password, and it's a very long password. And what that does, it unlocks basically a list of accounts, usernames, and passwords. And I have probably 200 to 300 passwords in there. And we talked about how many passwords people have to remember. It's an enormous number. Some I use only every few years, right? The password to manage my retirement account for work, which I pretty much never look at, but once in a great while I need it. So this password manager allows me to have long random passwords. A password safe has a button where it generates random passwords, and you have to think them up. And then I will just cut and paste them into the password window when I open that account. So I think password managers are great. It is an extension of the put this piece of paper in your pocket idea. And if you can do that, I'm really in favor of it, because it really does force people, well, incent people to have good password hygiene.
So are password managers more secure than the average online service? I would expect, if we're going to trust them with all of our passwords, that they must be pretty well protected.
Well, I wouldn't put a password manager online. That seems crazy. So I would not use a password manager that stores the passwords online unless they're stored encrypted. PasswordSafe stores it locally on my computer. So there's no cloud, there's no web, there's no online. It's just a file on my computer. Now, that has drawbacks because it's only on my computer, it's not on my phone. Other systems will have a way you can sync your password manager with different devices. Generally, what they do is they just encrypt the file. So that would be secure. Again, the devil's in the details here. I don't know about the other password managers, but in general, they are a good system here.
I want to talk a little bit about the idea of a strong password. The webcomic, the very popular webcomic XKCD, did a panel quite a while ago on creating a strong passphrase instead of a single word, and claiming these phrases were easier to remember and harder to crack. Is there truth to that? Was correct horse battery staple a good strong password before it was published on the panel?
Yes. I mean, back then, that was a good idea. We're finding in the latest password crackers, both the ones that are hacker tools and the ones that are legitimate, is they are now using those techniques to generate candidate passwords to break. So those passwords have become breakable. The advice I give, if you want to create a secure password you can remember, is to create a sentence and then use the first letters of each word of the sentence with some tricks and punctuation. So I'm going to make up one right now based on something I am looking at. The lamp is on the table. That's my sentence. So my password might be TLI space ON space TTABLE... Okay, so I just made that up. Now, the sentence I can remember. The tricks are pretty good, right? On is a word separated by spaces, and I have three periods at the end. And I just generated a secure password. Now, I can't do that for hundreds. I could do that for a few. But that is the correct trick. You can substitute numbers. I mean, a better sentence might have had a word that can easily be substituted for a number. So the word one might become a one. And or something might become a piece of punctuation. An A can become an at sign. That is the mnemonic for remembering that still works. The XKCD trick, I believe, is no longer secure.
So I'm thinking maybe one of the best combinations is to have some kind of password management tool, and for the services you have to log into all the time, maybe use your trick where you use a sentence and adapt it in some way so it's sort of easy to remember but also a stronger password. And then for things you don't have to log into, maybe use randomly generated ones. Because, you know, if I had to go check my password manager every time I logged into Facebook, I'd probably find that pretty frustrating after a while.
But Facebook, you're going to remember. If you're logging in every day, you're going to remember it eventually. Your muscle memory will remember it. I find that even the long, random, secure passwords, after a few weeks using them every day, I just start remembering them. My fingers remember it. Now, another thing that's going on here to remember is that your browser can remember passwords. So something like Facebook, your browser will say at some point, do you want me to remember this password for you? And you can say yes or no. Now, think of what's going on here. Basically, when you say yes, you're saying, I trust this computer, and I will let the computer log into the system. Now, if you have a good password on your computer, if you don't lose your computer regularly, that might be a good idea for some of these systems.
So do those browsers that remember your login credentials, do they store your login credentials in an encrypted way, or are those easy to crack?
It depends on the browser. I use Firefox, and Firefox has the option of securing all of those passwords with a master password, much like a password manager. Or you can say, you know, the computer itself is password protected and encrypted because your Windows machine, your Mac machine, you can set it up to encrypt the entire hard drive. And if you have that, you can just move the trust backwards into logging into the computer. Now, again, this is going to matter, right? One password isn't the same as another. There's a password for your bank. There's a password for your eBay account. There's a password for PayPal, for Facebook, for your email. There's a password for your account at a retailer, for the New York Times. You know, these have different security properties, and you're going to care different amounts about whether someone hacks it. If someone hacks my New York Times account, I don't actually care at all. If someone hacks my bank, it matters a great deal. So you might have different rules depending on the type of account.
That's interesting, because not a lot of people talk about the idea of not caring if your account is hacked. We talk and focus very much on you have to care and use a different password for everything. But my grocery list app on my phone is password protected. I had to create an account. And does it make sense maybe to have some sort of throwaway, easy to remember, simple password for those accounts you don't care about?
100% yes. It is perfectly reasonable to use the same easy, dumb password for all those accounts you don't actually care about. Yes.
So to some extent, this is about prioritizing your security and saying, this I care about, this deserves a strong password. This I don't care about, this can just be password.
Agreed. And it's something in the middle. Although don't choose password. Be a little better than that. You will just embarrass us.
Right.
And password one is not better, right? That doesn't help much. Another piece of advice we haven't talked about is changing passwords. The conventional wisdom is you should change passwords regularly. That's basically wrong. You should not change your password unless you believe it has been compromised.
We are told, and I worked for a company a long time ago, where we were required, in fact, to change our password every 3 months, something that who worked there found really frustrating.
Right. Lots of companies have that, and basically that incents people to choose lousy passwords. Because what you probably did is choose the same password with a rolling year, rolling number of months, and because you hated it, you never got to the point you could remember a password. You never chose a good password. That's generally bad advice. Companies are changing. You know, 10 years ago, there were all these password changing policies every 3 months, every month, every year. We're seeing less and less of that now as sort of the new practices are promulgating through the system.
I want to also talk about password reset tools, because almost every service has one, and often they contain these security questions to help verify our identity. But a lot of the questions they ask aren't that secure. The answer is common knowledge or easy to find out. I'm thinking a person's maiden name, a place of birth, even my first car wouldn't be too hard to guess at given enough guess attempts. So this doesn't seem like the best way to verify an identity in the case of a lost password.
Oh, it's terrible. It's a bad system. If you think about it, what it is, it's taking a system that has a level of security and having a backup system with even less security. And the famous example in the United States was Vice Presidential candidate Sarah Palin. Her email account was hacked from her secret question. The secret question was, what high school did you meet your husband at? Now, there weren't a whole lot of high schools in the area of Alaska she grew up. It was pretty obvious. Paris Hilton. She had an account hacked through her secret question, which I believe was her dog's name. So, yes, these are very insecure systems, and they're backup systems for remembering the password. I mean, my advice is not to use these systems. If you're forced to, think up a very, very obscure question, have the answer be random, and put that question and answer in your password manager, because those are very common ways attackers will get at your system by bypassing your password entirely.
I also wanted to mention two-step verification, because that's getting a lot of attention lately. What is two-step verification, quickly, for people who don't know?
Well, this is a way to shore up a password. When we were talking about how bad passwords are, there are other ways to do authentication. A password is something you know. Another piece of authentication is something you have. So a physical token, the key that goes into your house, is in a sense an authentication token. Anyone with that physical key can get into the house. Another type of authentication is something you are. Think of a biometric. If any of your listeners have an iPhone, they might have enabled the thumbprint login. Instead of a four-digit PIN, what it does is it uses your thumbprint. That's something you are. So two-step verification is a way of combining two things, a password and a token, a password and a biometric. Now, so let's use Facebook as an interesting example. When Facebook sees you log in from a strange computer, they have you do something else. So an extra security step. If you log in from your normal computer, your password works as normal. But if it's a strange computer, you know, let's say a hotel, you're traveling, they might ask you to verify pictures of people you know. Other systems will send a message to your phone, an SMS, and say, you know, type in this number. So these are ways to shore up people's lousy password management skills with another type of authentication. In general, these are great. Some game systems use tokens. So some online games, which can be very valuable, and people don't want their accounts hacked, also very desirable to attack accounts, sometimes will give you a security token, which might have a small screen where numbers keep changing. You have to type in the current number.
So I have two-step verification set up through my email system, and I moved recently, and of course, I moved to a place where I had to get a new phone number, and I didn't even think of it before I changed my phone number, and I can't even fully describe the moments of panic I had when I thought I was locked out of my email account for good. So two-step seems like a great solution, but there's also some extra responsibility you have to take if you set some of those up.
Yeah, all of these systems tend to fail around the edges. They work normally until something happens. You lose your phone, you lose your computer. In your case, you moved and got a new phone number. And yeah, you have to pay attention to what's going on. They tend to have reset systems. Right? You didn't get locked out of your email. They figured it out. But the more easy to use those exception handling systems are, the more vulnerable they are to breaking. There are lots of pretty famous stories of hackers pretending to be you, calling and saying, hey, you know, I moved and I got a new phone number and I need to get into my email, and social engineering their way in. So we're really trying very hard to balance a number of things, ease of use and security and adaptability. And this is hard. It's actually not an easy problem. But the more responsibility the user takes, the more secure they will be.
It seems like passwords aren't going anywhere anytime soon. But you did mention biometrics, and that seems like either an alternative or an addition to, in the case of two-step verification, the idea of passwords. Are there better things than passwords out there that we can use to secure our data?
You know, better depends on your definition. Is better more secure? Is better easier to use? Is better harder to fail? Passwords really have a unique niche because they are so good. You know, they might not be the most secure, but they really are the best. That's why they're everywhere. Biometrics takes money. The iPhone has to have a special fingerprint reader in order for that biometric to work. But we've seen other biometrics. There are biometrics where you put your face in front of a camera. There are biometrics based on hand geometry. And I suspect we're going to see more and more of these things in the coming years because the sensors are just getting cheaper. So what's better depends on a lot of things, and it's changing. There have been any number of systems that are trying to kill passwords and replace them. They've all failed, not because they're less secure, but because they're harder to use and more annoying. You know, the change is going to be things that happen around the edges. The Apple change to the iPhone was a big deal. You know, now suddenly millions of people are using fingerprint verification where they weren't last year. And if that becomes cheap and easy, you might see that same fingerprint reader on the next Apple Macintosh, right, on your laptop. And you might start seeing them on Windows computers. And suddenly that becomes everywhere, and now it's a new type of authentication. So is it better? Is it worse? It's different.
Bruce, thanks so much for being here and talking us through some of the password stuff. If you had one takeaway for people, if the only thing they took away from this conversation was what you're about to say next, what would you like that to be?
For accounts that matter, you need to choose a password you cannot remember, write it down, and put it in your wallet.
Awesome. Bruce, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
If you'd like to learn more about security technology, you can find Bruce online at www.schneier.com. A link you'll find on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And while you're visiting websites, we'd also love for you to visit our Facebook page, our Google Plus page, or our Twitter feed, where you can keep up with the latest news from the Science for the People team. You can, of course, also find us on iTunes, where you can leave a review of the show, subscribe to future shows, and check out all of our past episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Science for the People.